Hi there, and welcome to another one of my podcasts. This is July now, but you'll be hearing this on the 1st of August. Yes, we're still in the grip of this COVID-19. They're beginning to take the locks off the lockdown, but I don't know what's going on. Will we get it all starting up again? Well, we shall see. In the meantime, I have been digitizing a lot of my records, which means I've got more to play you. And I'm going to begin with Sam Mayo. I didn't know until I looked him up that he was actually Jewish. He was born Samuel Cowan, and he first worked in his father's second-hand shop while on the side collecting bets, which was probably illegal back then. And then he would also sing his songs at local pubs and clubs, together with his brothers Ted and Morris. He got married in 1904, but unfortunately, his love of gambling stayed with him the rest of his life, and he was three times declared bankrupt. What I like about him is, unlike most of the other performers of the day who tend to be loud and blustery, he is sort of quiet and lugubrious, and nobody was really like him. He tended to sing at the grand piano wearing either a long overcoat or even a dressing gown, and wrote a series of songs and performed them like nobody else. I'm not even going to try to describe his style, but I'm going to give it to you because you'll hear him sing in a minute. This is pretty typical of his output. It's called The Night Began to Fall, and there are various little stories that go with that line. He must have been very popular because at one point in 1905, he managed to perform at 9 different venues the same evening. It's a bit like doing more than one comedy club now. Things don't really change that much. He was born in 1877. As I said, got married, had children, but his end was rather sad because his own son died of tuberculosis in 1937, and he himself died of a heart attack while playing a game of snooker a year later. He's to be found, if you want to see his headstone, in the Wilton Jewish Cemetery, which is how I discovered that he was Jewish. Well, enough about Sam Mayo. Apart from one thing, let's hear him perform. He really is like nobody else, and I've always been a fan since I first heard a track of him. Sam Mayo.
Fat Malone and I, a cabin had to share upon an open boat, and the first night afloat, when we started to undress, the fair time being said, a lady's nightgown I put on, then popped into me bed. Then the night began to fall, she got a murmur fat, why do you wear a lady's gown to sleep and tell me that? I said, if there's a shipwreck and the worst comes to the worst, you silly fool, they always save the women and children first. I went to have me fortune told by some old gypsy dame, and the funny thing she said made me blush pink and red. She murmured, cross the gypsy's palm with gold, me bonny lad. So I crossed it with the goldfish, that was all the gold I had. Then the night began to fall, on me she cast a spell. She said, you've got no children, sir, that I can plainly tell. A father you have never been, I went all cold and hot. Then I said, well, if that's the case, from whose of the 9 I've got? Once I felt very ill and thought that I was going to die. I don't know what I had, but I felt really bad. The undertaker came around to cheer me up, and he told me of all the jobs he had down at the cemetery. Then the night began to fall, as by me bed he sat. Then all at once me bedroom door he started glaring at. I said, what's wrong? Then he replied, well, as you're rather stout, I was thinking, what an awful door for getting the coffin out. The other night when I got home, I knocked and knocked and knocked. I rang and rang and rang, and gave the front door a bang, but no one answered me at all, so there amongst the flowers, I sat for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. Then the night began to fall, I sat there in dismay, till Mary Ann, my sister, cried, your wife's been taken away. She's gone with Betty tonight, as in a cab, said Mary Ann. I said, well, fancy going with him. murdered your ice cream man.
Ever since the mid-30s, I suppose, if you think of the duet between a violin and a guitar in terms of jazz, you will think of Stefan Grappelli and, of course, Django Reinhardt. But they weren't the first. The first two, well, I'm going to talk about them now. Salvatore Massaro was born in 1902 and died at the age of 30 in March 1933. Nobody remembers that name because he was known much more widely as Eddie Lang, and he played, of course, very often with a wonderful violinist who survived him by many decades, Joe Venuti. It's funny to think now that before Eddie Lang, you hardly ever heard a guitar solo. And it wasn't his first instrument. He was actually the son of an Italian immigrant and was born in Philadelphia, and his childhood friend was indeed Joe Venuti. He himself first played violin and performed on it, even became a member of a sort of violin trio. But in 1920, he dropped the violin for the banjo and then joined a band called Charlie Kerr or Carr and various other orchestras. The thing about the banjo is, in the days before microphones, it cut through the band, you could hear it. But later on, he was obviously attracted to the guitar with its more mellow sound and soon became very adept on it. He was able, even by 1924, to record one of the first ever guitar solos on record. He was working at that time with the Mound City Blue Blowers, led by a sort of jazz singer called Red McKenzie. And his performances with that band got him noticed, and he began to be what we would call now, I suppose, a session player, and everybody wanted to have Eddie Lang in their band. And remember, before this, nobody had sort of been playing jazz guitar except very much in the background. So Lang, together with Joe Venuti, recorded with Roger Wolf-Kahn, Gene Colquitt, which are more sort of dance bands, I suppose, with the Adrian Rollini Orchestra. And then he got interested in playing with Lonnie Johnson, who, of course, was a black player. And although musicians were sort of colorblind, he was aware that to work with a black player on record might have been trouble. So he hid his identity by calling himself Blind Willie Dunn. He also worked alongside Frankie Trumbauer, Bix Beiderbecker, Hoagy Carmichael, Annette Hanshaw, Red Nichols, Bessie Smith even, and Clarence Williams. I heard him first on the very first 78 that I owned because he was accompanying Ruth Etting. A lot of singers liked to have him as their accompanist. And not least of these was Bing Crosby, who was just beginning to be a solo artist, and he heard Eddie Lang playing and they became great mates. And wherever Bing Crosby went, Eddie Lang went as well. This was all very, very good. But all this time, Eddie Lang kept getting laryngitis, wasn't nice, very nasty sore throat, and even digestion problems. In the end, a doctor recommended that he had a tonsillectomy, which I had when I was a little boy. And everybody thought that would be a good idea, and of course, everybody thought that that was a very routine operation. And so it was Eddie Lang entered hospital in Manhattan in 1933. And he never awoke from the surgeon's table. Nobody quite knows why he died, but obviously something went badly wrong, and now all we have are his records. Just a few months before he died, he got together with another guitarist. The history of jazz guitarists often found jazz guitarists working together. They have a sort of bond between them. And just as Eddie Lang was developing what he did, and he played, remember, in a guitar with very heavy duty strings, quite often quite a long way off the keyboard, so it was difficult to play fast on it. But they developed at that time, on the acoustic guitar of the day, a sort of chord solo approach. And his friend Carl Kress was definitely working on that and was almost taking over from Eddie Lang and taking things to the next level. On the 15th of January in 1932, they made a couple of tracks. This is one of them. It's called Picking My Way. A wonderful duet between Eddie Lang and Carl Kress, nothing else. So here is Eddie Lang. Thank you. And now we jump back a quarter of a century and we change genres because we're going to listen to the sadly mostly forgotten soprano known as Lisa Landuzzi. She was a coloratura soprano, also occasionally a lyric soprano. And like Eddie Lang, she changed her name. I'm not quite sure why. Her real name was actually Elise Béville. She had quite a long life, particularly for those days. She was born in 1861 and she died in 1943. She was a pretty girl, very French-looking, and she was a fine singer. She made her debut in 1889 as Rosina in Il Barbiere di Siviglia, no doubt in French, because her career was pretty much all in France, or France and Belgium, French-speaking countries. And she had a big success at the Opéra Comique, which was one of the two great opera houses of Paris. And she sang there many, many times. Perhaps the most important performance of her life was the French premiere of Verdi's last opera, Falstaff. Not only was it the premiere of that opera in France, but Verdi himself, at the age of, I think, 81, was there in the audience. In the early years of the 20th century, she got signed up by Odeon, which was part of the company, which in Italy she probably would have been on the Phonotypia label, but they were the same company somehow. They were connected, certainly. And she made quite a few records for them, and I've got quite a few. This is her recording in 1907 of a famous coloratura aria from La Perle du Brésil, probably the only opera which is remembered from a French composer called David. All the great sopranos who sang coloratura roles sang this aria, Calicorci, Tetrazzini, and the rest. This is Lisa Landuzzi's performance, and rather charmingly, as they did on Odeon back then, because it somehow got kept a habit from the days when people recorded on cylinders and there weren't any labels, she actually introduces this herself in a little high speaking voice. So, here is Lisa Landuzzi singing Charmant Oiseau.
Thank you.
A fine singer and probably underrated. Well, now, I don't know much about this pair of singers. I know that one of them was called Fred Douglas, and I don't know much about him. And the other half of this group, which is called the Two Gilberts, apparently wasn't always the same chap. So I can't really tell you who these people were on this particular record. What I can say is that this is an interesting record because it marks, in a way, the demise of proper English music hall. This record was made in the 20s, and by this time, the BBC and its Calvinist leader was beginning to impose all sorts of censorship on anything that was even slightly dodgy. And therefore, comedy was minimised, and if you couldn't just write a fairly, what should we say, harmless song that derived its humour from just being silly, then you couldn't get on the radio. And that got rid of so much talent that might have come to the fore had the BBC not been behaving like that. Well, this is one of those songs. I remember hearing it still when I was a child, at least the title line. And the name of the song is "When It's Night Time in Italy, It's Wednesday Over Here." And there's other various silly comparisons throughout the song. And no doubt the Two Gilberts enjoyed a certain amount of success because they were able to play this game. However, from what I've been able to read, I'm not even certain that they were a live act. There may have just been two people who went into the studio and made duet records, but didn't work as a double act on the stage. I may be wrong about that, but anyway, here we go. This recording is from 1923, right at the beginning of the years when the BBC started operating. But it seems to me that they were already working to what they thought they needed to do to get on the radio. I could be completely wrong, as I say, but that's the impression that I'm getting. So here they are, 1923, the Two Gilberts, 2 years before the microphone came into the studio, singing "When It's Nighttime in Italy, It's Wednesday Over Here."
I've lost my appetite, my hair is turning grey. He knew his Greek and history, his Latin was a pie. But if east is east and west is west, then won't you tell me why? When it's night time in Italy, it's Wednesday over here. When it's weekday in Birmingham, in Eldon they eat gripe and trotter. Why does a fly? Why does a bee? How does a wasp sit down to have its tea? But the butter on butterfly won't make bread disappear. When it's night time in Italy and Wednesday over here. When it's night time in Italy, it's Wednesday over here. That's the reason old Pussyfoot has got water on the brain department. Down with a drink. Then what I'll say, down with a drink. I shall have you today. But the day that old Pussyfoot makes England dry eyes fear, will be night time in Italy and Wednesday over here. This learned, learned college boy stood up in class and said, I've looked up my geography and found out Caesar's dead. The reason I speak Portuguese is I'm some clever guy. But if Charlie Boo means how you do, then we want to know why. When it's night time in Italy, it's Wednesday over here. When our coals are to bob a ton and lions feed us all for stuffing, we'll push and go. We'll get a pun, 1 hour for work, and 2 hours off for lunch, yeah. And we'll never have profiteer, and grub won't be so dear. When it's night time in Italy, and Wednesday over here. When it's night time in Italy, and Wednesday over here.
When our MPs make promises, they'll make us laugh like Tommy Webster. We'll win a fight when we have found one the heavyweight to last all their one round.
And the landlord won't worry us to pay our rent, no fear.
When it's night time in Italy and Wednesday over here.
And from a fairly forgettable musical variety song, we move to a sensational jazz record. In January 1944, there was a live concert at the New York Town Hall, which you can hear in full on YouTube. The second tune was something called Mop Mop, a sort of bebop type tune written by Leonard Feather, who was in fact a British jazz fan who emigrated to America and became a well-regarded jazz critic and promoter. And he often put together sessions with some of the greatest jazz musicians of all time. In the concert in January 1944, the lineup was slightly different. Instead of the trumpeter Cootie Williams, who was on this 78, they had Roy Eldridge. I think I prefer Cootie Williams. But they also had Barney Bigard replacing Edmund Hall, and I prefer Barney Bigard. It doesn't really matter, because great as these musicians were, they're completely wiped out by one soloist. Also in the band, and nominally its leader on this 78, is Coleman Hawkins, probably the father of tenor saxophone. There's Al Casey, the fine guitarist, who usually had been playing with Fats Waller, but Fats Waller died in December 1943. The great Oscar Pettiford, one of, if not the greatest bass player, and Big Sick Catlett, one of my favourite drummers. However, I haven't mentioned the person who steals the record. His name was Art Tatum. He's an absolute monster, and I think it was very brave for anybody to try and take a solo after he'd finished. This is the studio version, therefore, of Mop Mop. It's recorded on the 4th of December, 1943, about a month before the concert in the New York Town Hall, which, as I say, you can hear in full on YouTube, and I think it's possibly the greatest jazz concert of all time. Also in that concert were Louis Armstrong, Billie Holiday, Mildred Bailey, at least two great vibraphone players. You can probably guess who they were. If you haven't been there, go and listen to that concert. Meanwhile, here is the original studio version of Mop Mop, and it's sensational.
Thank you.
my last track, I return to opera, and this time the soprano and later mezzo-soprano, Pia Tassinari. She had a long life. She was born in 1903, and she only died in 1995. And she later, in her career, well, when she was, I don't know, in her 30s, she married the great tenor, Ferruccio Tagliavini. It was probably unusual in those days to marry a man 10 years younger than she was, but it seemed to have been a very happy marriage. She was a very fine singer. I particularly like her in operas by Puccini, Mascagni, but of course she sang all sorts of roles, quite often by modern composers like Zandonai, Wolf Ferrari, and Respighi. When she was about 50, she must have thought that her top notes were becoming difficult or her lower notes were coming richer. I don't know which it was, but she then started singing mezzo roles, particularly Carmen, Charlotte, Amneris in Aida, and so forth. Here, recorded in 1941, she was in her late 30s, probably at the peak of her powers, and she sings Son Pochi Fiori from Mascagni's opera, L'Amico Fritz. As I understand it, in his young days, when he was a student, he actually shared a flat with Puccini. I don't know how much they learnt from one another at that time, but listening to this particular aria, I have the feeling that it could have easily been written by Puccini. It's got the same sort of sound. It's very emotional. I love the aria. So this is Pia Tassinari, who sang these arias beautifully. In fact, she made her debut as Mimi from Puccini's, of course, La Bohème in 1929. She was wonderful in these roles. Wonderful sound, tremendous emotion in the voice. So I highly recommend this recording to you. Pia Tassinari, recorded on the 25th of August 1941, Son Pochi Fiori.
Profumo gentile
And now we come to my track. Before I do so, I'm just filling you in on how things are progressing in this strange COVID-19 period. It's very unclear as to whether Boris Johnson and his merry men are opening the country up or closing it down. There's conflicting stories all the time. One minute, open up. Next minute, no, you must wear masks. I don't know what's going on. Meantime, I'm digitizing more of my 78s and still wondering when I'm going to start having any gigs. I did watch online somehow. It didn't always work. And certainly listen on the radio to Test Match Special. And two test matches. The first cricket of the year, because I'm fed up with football getting in the way of the summer. And these two matches, despite being played without a crowd, must be strange for people who are actually there. But for people like me watching or listening, it hardly made a difference. A fantastic couple of test matches, both very close. I thought the second one would be ruined because one of the days was completely rained off in Manchester. But in fact, it led to a very, very exciting finale where England just got over the line with about an hour to spare. Fantastic. Which evens up the series and means that the third match, which takes place on Friday, will be the decider. England versus the West Indies. Pretty evenly matched team, so it's going to be wonderful. Well, that said, what am I going to play you of mine this time, having reminded you to share the link to this site with as many people as you can? And also, if you want to start buying 78s, I'm the person you should come to because I charge less than dealers do. Well, the track I've chosen this time, I've only just found about 10 years or so ago, I had the luck to be invited to give a concert in São Paulo in Brazil. I don't remember getting this track, but somebody recorded me during the sound check and I was checking out the grand piano. And decided to have a go at playing Duke Ellington's 1920s composition, Black Beauty. And I actually played it quite well. At the end of this recording, I can hear myself going into solitude as well, but it fades out there, so you'll be spared that. So this is Earle Oaten, yours truly, trying to play Duke Ellington's Black Beauty about 10 years ago. And with that, until next time, I say au revoir.
And now I'm just going to practice a little bit.